From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. We start today's show with a story about apples. Helen Rosner's The New Yorker's roving food correspondent, noted for her incredible writing on all aspects of food. This week, she wrote an essay titled, How Apples Go Bad. We've asked her to read it for us. The essay's fronted with a quote from Robert O'Brien, White House National Security Advisor. There's a few bad apples that are giving law enforcement a terrible name. Here's Helen.
An apple tree in bloom is a thing of majesty. Arm-like branches held aloft in an eternal pose of praise, or perhaps exasperation, wreathed in a stippled cloud of blossoms. Bees rest on the flower's quivering stamens to sip their golden nectar, then move in drunken joy to another tree, their legs and backs powdered with pollen. When the pollen from one tree's flower meets the pistil of the flower of another, a small miracle of creation occurs. Apples take months to grow. The fruit from a flower fertilized in April may not reach maturity until October or November. Only then will it begin to ripen. All apples are born from members of the same species, Malus domestica. But in a manner more familiar to us in Animalia than plantae, their offspring don't grow true to seed. The child of a round speckled winesap and a muscular Gravenstein might resemble one or both of its parents, or it might go off on a path entirely of its own. The calculated sweetness of a Honeycrisp, the astonishing ruby flesh of a pink pearl, the early ripening of a Carolina red June, the bumps and warts of a knobbed russet. There are thousands and thousands of named cultivars and innumerable varieties unnamed. Perhaps owing to these gonzo genetics, apples are remarkably susceptible to disease and rot. Their tender skin and light flesh are a haven for small creatures. Their trees embrace myriad molds, viruses, and fungi. Apple scab, black pox, southern blight, union necrosis. For farmers and hobby gardeners, the business of apple growing is not so much aiding the fruits in their growth as scrambling to ward off their demise. Blight spreads quickly, and it's not always apparent on the fruit's surface. Even without the influence of invader or infection, an apple abets its own spoilage. Its skin, minutely porous, exhales ethylene, a gaseous compound that induces ripening, and the fruit has no interest in stopping at the point where it serves our needs. The closer an apple is to rot, the more rot it spreads. One spoiling apple in a crisper drawer or a fruit bowl or a storage barrel or a cross-country shipping container or even still hanging on the bough speeds the rot of every apple it touches, and even of ones it doesn't touch. The whole bunch quickly begins to exemplify what the artist Klaus Oldenburg called the brown, sad art of rotting apples, a swamp of ferment, infecting the air with the hideous sweetness of decay. Chaucer was likely the first to write a version of the now commonplace proverb, a rotten apple's better thrown away before it spoils the barrel. But I'm partial to Benjamin Franklin's version, the rotten apple spoils his companions. The saying is often used to refer to the corruption of select individuals within a group, but the point is the fruit's susceptibility to collective rot. We are in the war zone against this disease, George Sundin, a fruit tree pathologist at Michigan State University, said in 2019 about fire blight, the most recent major threat to apples. The process of eradicating it is not necessarily trial and error, he added. It is things we know are effective, but they need to be more effective. If the disease takes off, it can spread so quickly. The only way to avoid rot is to be proactive. Check every apple, every tree. At the first sight of something amiss, a bruise or broken skin, a sunken place, toss that apple out, but don't stop there. Scrub all the others and monitor them closely, but know that it's likely already too late. Better to trim and burn the infected branch, or even the whole tree.
That was Helen Rosner, roving food correspondent at The New Yorker. For more of her work, go to newyorker.com. Today on the show, we investigate the rot. First up, for over a century, Black farmers have been shut out of loans and federal assistance. And as the government prepares another aid package to help struggling farmers hit hard by the pandemic, Black farmers are once again left wondering if they will be left with no support. That story when Good Food continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Farming in America is a tough profession. Farming while Black is a whole other story. 80% of land owned by Black Americans has been lost since 1910, the result of bad policy and discriminatory loan practices. That is billions of dollars of generational wealth in today's money that was never allowed to flourish. When the CARES Act was signed into law on March 27th, promising $2 trillion in aid, it seemed at face value like a good idea. The bill included relief for small farmers and farmers who grow specialty crops, meaning the fruits and vegetables that humans actually eat versus the corn and soy that are sold as commodity crops. But, and there's always a but, that money was to be allocated according to the desires of the USDA, an agency that historically has not been supportive of Black farmers. Greg Kaufman is a freelance journalist covering poverty in America and a contributor to The Nation. So this relief money that's supposed to flow into farmers' pockets, has anyone been able to access it?
So it's pretty stunning that only now, at the end of May, did the USDA open for applications for these monies. The amount of time it took is pretty disconcerting. The other thing that was disconcerting is they just didn't have a lot of answers about who was eligible for a really long time. And now they have some answers, but they don't necessarily have answers that are particularly important for the African-American community, for farmers in the Black Belt, in the rural Black Belt in particular. And I'm thinking of people who don't have access to broadband and might not be able to file applications, people who don't have a local farm service agency near them.
Are these funds earmarked for farmers at certain levels, or can a huge farm, for example, that does millions of dollars a year apply for the same funds that small farmers are waiting for?
Yeah, and it's kind of tricky. I mean, one of the problems is the language of who's eligible and who's not is so hard to navigate. So for example, they sent me this press release just the other day saying eligibility, there's a payment limitation of $250,000 per person or entity, but applications who are corporations may qualify for additional payment limits. So the answer to your question is, yeah, they can. And you know, the limitation of $250,000 seemed good at first glance because one of the problems with USDA assistance is the corporate agriculture gets such outsized benefits and assistance and loans. And so the limitation looks good, but then there's that language that says, well, if you're a corporation or some other entity, you might get a lot more.
Can we talk a little bit about the relationship that the USDA has had historically with Black farmers?
Absolutely.
I mean, one issue that we've talked about on this show from time to time is this issue of heirs property, which seems to affect Black farmers more than any other community. Could you describe what heirs property is?
Yes. Heirs property, it's a practice that was started due to the obstacles that African-American families faced in trying to obtain title for their farm. So they passed along the land without having a will that went through probate and those formal processes. And what it's meant is, and it, apparently it impacts up to 60% of all African-American farmers, it's meant that they're not eligible for most USDA assistance, including the kind of disaster assistance we're talking about today. So, for example, in the 1984 to 1985 farm crisis, the USDA lent $1.3 billion, billion with a B, to 16,000 farmers, and barely 1% of those farmers were African American. And the land loss that you were talking about in your opening, the 16 million acres down to, I believe it's 2 to 3 million acres today, with most of that loss coming in the last 70 years, you know, a good chunk of that can be attributed to heirs' property. So that is something that I've really, since the end of March, been talking to them about. Because as you know, as you discussed on your show, there was a fix for that that passed in the 2018 Farm Bill. So you would think this is a huge problem impacting up to 60% of African-American farmers. They passed this fix in 2018. I guess it was officially passed in January 2019, but it was the 2018 Farm Bill. And the proposed implementation of that fix only reached the White House this March of 2020, and it's still not implemented. And so one of the first questions I asked, again, starting in the end of March, or whenever the CARES Act passed, it seems like forever ago now, is what are you going to do about people who own their farms through heirs' property? Are they going to be able to get assistance? And they didn't answer. Now, I can tell you that I finally got an email today, and the spokesperson said, then I want to get this just right, that being an heirs' property owner does not automatically disqualify someone from assistance, and they encourage farmers to contact their local FSA, Farm Service Agency office, to complete an application and ask questions specific to their heir's property situation. And I suppose it's good they're saying something, but I would say that there's still such a lack of clarity. The onus is on the farmer. They've been sitting on this rule for almost 2 years, I guess. And, you know, I have to wonder if this were had been 60% of white farmers unable to get assistance for all these years, if the conversation would be very different. And I would also say, I just want to add that saying, that these farmers should just apply and contact their FSA office. Again, a lot of these farmers don't even have broadband. They don't have an office nearby. They just haven't done anything to really take down those barriers that I can see.
And we should say that the crux of this issue is just the ability to get a farm number assigned. Because that's in right. order to apply or receive assistance, you need to have a farm number.
Right. And that's exactly what the 2018 proposal was supposed to address. So I don't know why we're still sitting around waiting for this. And I'm really glad you're having this conversation today, because this is exactly the kind of structural racism that people are in the streets protesting. I mean, this isn't a new problem. This has been going on for generations. We have a fix that, and we're sitting on it. Nobody's asking questions. You are today, and some people are. And you know, you don't see the kind of outrage you would see if this was a problem affecting white people.
Thank you, Greg. I am so thrilled to have read you and discovered you, and I look forward to many more conversations.
Well, thank you very much, Evan, and I'm happy to be on your show, and I look forward to talking to you again, too.
That was Greg Kaufman. He's a freelance journalist who covers poverty in America. He's a contributor to The Nation. Thank you. For years, private chefs Daniel Bell and Pablo Osorio have been creating intimate dinners featuring savory food inspired by Pablo's Peruvian roots and sweets from Daniel's American South. But every Juneteenth, they set aside their usual menus to express the bittersweetness at the heart of the African-American celebration. Sometimes called Freedom Day, the June 19th holiday is an official observance of emancipation. And of course, there is food on the table. Danielle's here to share her thoughts about the holiday and how she approaches the menus. Hi.
Hi.
I hope you and Pablo have been taking good care of yourselves this week.
We have, actually. We just got back from Idlewild. We spent two nights there. We needed it, but we're back now.
Oh, that's so good that you did that. Tell us about Juneteenth. For folks who don't know about the holiday, can you explain what it's all about?
So Juneteenth was founded by men who should have been free, but they weren't told about the Emancipation Proclamation until 2 years after it already had taken place. And so we celebrate Juneteenth on June 19th. It's shortened, I guess, vernacular Juneteenth. Various people have different ways of approaching the holiday. Edna Lewis actually didn't celebrate Juneteenth. They chose a different date to celebrate Black independence, for example. But Pablo and I like to celebrate it and use it as a way to bring people together and tell various stories. Our focus last year and this year will be on Kentuckians, Black Kentuckians, and their contributions to Kentucky's culinary history, often overlooked.
Is that because that's where you're from?
Yes, really, it is only because that's where I'm from. But 2 years ago, I was at the downtown library in their cookbook section, and I just randomly came across a book called The Bluegrass Cookbook, and I didn't really expect much, but I opened it. It's by Minnie C. Fox, and what made it special to me was that this wealthy white woman had recipes from the homes of her friends and also her own home. That's not really all that special. What is special is that she had photographs, really beautiful photographs taken of the Black men and women who ran those homes and cared for her and her peers. And so you got to see them at work, cooking, baking, tending to crops in this beautiful, artful way. And really spoke to me. So we decided to use that book as inspiration. What also distinguished it for me is that I often don't think of Kentucky as very distinctive in terms of our culinary scene. I was wrong for that, but I think maybe because where I'm from Louisville, a lot of times the food kind of feels more pan-Southern than anything. Like, we don't have Memphis barbecue ribs. We don't have, you know, a low country cuisine. We're not New Orleans. But it was really kind of cool to see these, the book was published in 1904, so it was really cool to see these menus and these dishes that were really, really decadent. There were like maybe 10 recipes for sweetbreads. There was a lot of quail. There was, you know, I liked the idea of rural Black Kentuckians making this hot cuisine.
Could you give us an idea of a couple of dishes that Pablo is working on and what you're planning on for the sweet finale?
Yes. So we're going to, because we can't do the dinner in person, we're borrowing from that menu from last year. It's going to be a little different. This year, we're going to have a ridgeback prawn bisque, and we're going to do a market salad with pickled vegetables. We won't do the pig feet terrine that he did last year because we're delivering it. Not sure how well that would deliver. But we're going to have the blackberry cobbler and homemade ice cream. In that book, there were so many recipes for ice cream as well. And we're going to have the quail that's going to be smothered. And it's going to be served with Southern style greens, but also my grandmother's cornbread oyster dressing. That was on the menu last year, but we're going to bring it back this year.
Aside from the food that you and Pablo are making, could you give us an idea of what might be found on African-American tables to celebrate Juneteenth?
Sure. In the New York Times article that I'm in this week, Nicole makes a point, Nicole the writer, talks about how a lot of people will have some sort of red drink on the table. I mean, if I were in Kentucky right now celebrating Juneteenth, it would be barbecue. It's my grandmother's from Memphis. So she actually does sort of have a very true culinary identity. But yeah, we would have that. Ideally, I would like to see a lot of pickled vegetables. That's how we ate at my family. We would always have, for like a big meal, there would always be fresh vegetables on the table, like scallions and tomatoes and onions and vinegar, and you sort of add stuff to your dish. There would be greens that set most dinners. Who knows, maybe my grandmother would even break out some chitlins or something like that. I would personally contribute ice cream and cobbler. My grandmother and mom really like my pie crust, so that's what I would probably do. But other, you know, everybody has their traditions and have dishes that speak to them. So I imagine every table looks alike, but a bit different as well.
It must be really painful, particularly at this moment, that the pandemic isn't allowing for Black communities to come together physically to share joy in the way that one might typically celebrate on June 19th. Have you found social distancing incredibly difficult in how you're celebrating and sharing your food this year?
Yes, I have. Well, my mom's pretty sick at the moment, so not being able to even travel to Kentucky for any sort of anything to just simply give her a hug is pretty hard for me. But with regard to the dinner, last year's dinner really was so special. And I was especially happy that so many Black and Brown women were at the table with us that year. And it was just really heartwarming. And it was one of my favorite dinners, probably my favorite dinner that I've done 6 years of living in LA, and often thought of how I could recreate it. And I don't know that that's really possible, even through deliveries. I thought about maybe doing some sort of Zoom dinner, but I don't know. I don't really like Zoom all that much. And I just feel like it would be lost. What I will do is, with every order, I'm going to share my recipe for baked rice pudding. It's inspired by one of the two things my grandmother actually bakes. And maybe me and the people who receive it could bake it together or something, maybe share photos, or I don't know. It's just kind of it is a hard time. It is a bittersweet time, more bitter than sweet. So I'm trying to think of ways to sort of bring people together, and it's just different.
It's so hard this year. It's very hard. And I'm so, so sorry to hear about your mom. Well, I'm sure that everyone who gets your dinner will feel a connection to you and what you've put into it, because that's what food does really well.
I hope so. I really do. And yeah, there are various ways to connect. I might send flowers or something with the dinner, so it could kind of feel like what we try to do. Our dinner parties. I mean, that's really important to me, having fresh flowers and having candles. So I am thinking of ways of making the dinner special. I also want to say that with this Juneteenth dinner, 15% of our proceeds are going to go to the West Louisville Women's Collaborative. Louisville's in the press right now for a lot of terrible reasons, but it's a beautiful city and it has beautiful people, and these women are working the west side of Louisville, which is where I'm from. It's, you know, the red line, Black side of Louisville, and they promote art, meditation, gardening, wellness, quilting, and all sorts of activities to, you know, build a better West Louisville and support women and girls that live in that side of, on that side of town.
That's marvelous. Thank you for that, for telling us about that. Well, Danielle, I'm giving you a giant hug. I wish I could give you one in person.
I appreciate it.
I can taste your cobbler in my mouth right now.
Oh, yeah. I think you had it before. This year, it's going to be a mix of boysenberry and blackberry.
I have a flat of boysenberries on my table right now.
They're incredible. They're the best thing right now. They help.
Yes, they do. Danielle Bell is one half of Deporus, a dinner series she runs with her partner, Pablo Osorio. You can pre-order her Juneteenth menu from the Deporus website. That's deporres.com. We've also got a link at our site, kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, it's been quite a week for the food publishing world. We'll talk to two authors navigating food media, Walt Black. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. We've been talking about cooking fatigue here at Good Food. I live alone, and after 12 weeks of basically being a shut-in, I'm not making lasagna or babysitting jars of sourdough starter. What would I even do with all those loaves? In her 2016 book, Cooking Solo, Clancy Miller reminds us of some of the joys of cooking for one. She's here today to share some inspiration. Hi, Clancy.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's just such a pleasure to have you. How many of us singletons, and I'm saying us, I don't know your current status.
Single.
Oh, there you go. How many of us are living alone in the U.S.? Are there a lot of us?
At the time I wrote my book, I think it was about 31 million, quite a lot. And one of the pieces of information that I added to my book proposal was that this most recent census at that time said that there were more single people than married people, which was a new point in our history here.
It's so fascinating. I'm just wondering, because of this book that you wrote and the subject matter, have you heard from a lot of people who went into this staying at home on their own?
I have. I think there a lot of people have been looking for inspiration and alternatives and ideas that have for meals that have single servings as opposed to tons of leftovers. So I've definitely heard from a lot of people.
Yeah, I found, as I'm sure all of us have, that my level of engagement on my own behalf has waxed and waned. So
yeah,
you know, some days I'm just really into baking, making a little cake that I can maybe share with neighbors. And mm-hmm. then just eating a burrito over the sink.
Totally. My lunch today was sardines on toast.
Oh, there you go. You put them on toast. That's a dish.
Yeah, I put them on toast with mustard. I did a lot more baking and I did some, I live on a higher floor in my apartment building and I would just kind of drop some baked goods out the window for friends who came over in the beginning part and it seemed cute and fun. And there have been periods when I've been totally tired of cooking and washing dishes. So my cooking habits change on a day-by-day basis or a week-by-week basis.
I would love if you would share what it is that you've been making, for one, when you want the pleasure of embracing the task, when you need to just put the world aside and just really enjoy working with your hands.
Last night's dinner was a pretty great example of that. I had some canned lobster and it was literally the kind of a serving size for one. And I have this very large supply of rigatoni and I happen to have some fresh basil too. So I sauteed the lobster in a little bit of olive oil and garlic. I added the cooked rigatoni, some chopped up fresh basil and maybe a tablespoon of cream and just a hint of lemon juice, sauteed that up. And it was amazing. It was a very satisfying, super simple meal. And I had that with a nice glass of Sauvignon Blanc. And I felt very pleased with myself. I actually have a recipe for a lobster pasta dish in my cookbook. And as the days in New York have been getting warmer and warmer, I have been thinking about that recipe for the past couple of days and just thinking, oh, I could go for my pasta salad with lobster. And lo and behold, it's like, oh, you've got that. You can make it.
So you have this background as a pastry chef.
Mm-hmm.
When you want something sweet, what do you do?
let's see, the things I've made a lot of recently are cookies because I love cookies. I've also, since strawberries are starting to come into season here, I've been making a strawberry shortcake for one, which I'm really proud to have kind of created. It's essentially a slightly oversized cupcake, but it is a cake for one. And I just whip my own cream and I like to macerate the strawberries in Saint-Germain, the liqueur.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, it's super decadent. It's not something I would have every day, but I've definitely maybe had one a week for the past couple of weeks.
When you make the cookies, do you roll them into logs and freeze them?
Yes, that is a technique I highly recommend for people who are cooking solo or for people who just don't want to bake an entire batch of cookies all at once. That's my little trick.
Yeah, for me, it's less about baking an entire batch and being worried about eating an entire batch.
Exactly, exactly. Same.
Can we talk about publishing? You're the founder of For the Culture, a biannual printed food magazine.
Correct.
Can you talk about that project?
Absolutely. So For the Culture, the tagline is a magazine celebrating Black women in food and wine. And I launched the crowdfunding campaign to create For the Culture in December. We reached our goal in February, or basically reached our goal. The goal was 40,000. I raised 38,000 on Indiegogo. And the goal of For the Culture is to really highlight Black women throughout the diaspora and for the stories to be written by Black women, photographed and illustrated by Black women. And I believe it will be the first magazine of its kind. And the reason why I wanted to do this is because I believe that Black women are very much the architects of cuisine in the U.S. and throughout many countries. And I feel like our expertise and experience hasn't really garnered the attention that I believe it deserves. So my hope is that For the Culture will help to correct that and to honor the women doing so many amazing things in food right now.
And where are you with the first issue? I would imagine that the pandemic interrupted the progress of its publication.
Yes, the pandemic has definitely affected the whole process. At first, I wanted to have kind of a broad theme of it's personal. So personal stories related to food or personal favorites, recipes that reflect family heirlooms, so to speak. But with COVID, since it's disproportionately affected Black and brown communities. And of course, since COVID has also been extremely hard on the food industry, I wanted to also have some stories that reflect that. So I extended the call for submissions and widened it and asked people to kind of pitch COVID-related stories. It's added on a little bit of time to the process, but I actually feel really grateful that hopefully the first issue will be able to capture even more of the moment that we're in. So it's a good thing, I think.
Can people still support the Indiegogo?
The Indiegogo closed in February. However, there is a Patreon page. And there's also, for the entire month of June and the beginning of July, there's a wonderful initiative that has been organized by bakers in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's called For the Culture Bake Sale, and it's an online bake sale. And bakers throughout Charlotte are raising funds through selling baked goods that will support For the Culture. So those are two different ways that people can support the magazine.
I'm so glad that people will be able to support this because I think that truly there's never been a more clear view of how important it is for people to own their own stories. So we are looking forward to this so much.
Thank you. I am too.
So this week, food media Twitter was on fire.
Yeah.
There were a lot of discussions about so many discussions about just horrifying workplace environments at large publishing houses like Bon Appetit. We actually had, as a result, the resignation of the editor-in-chief, Adam Rappaport. Mm-hmm. An incredible thing to watch in real time on Twitter, I have to say.
Absolutely.
And then just a much larger conversation about the underrepresentation of people in color and indigenous folks, Black folks, in the world of food media and publishing, and a hashtag developed that was publishing paid me, which is just, has been fascinating to watch.
Yeah, it's revelatory.
Yeah, I would love it if you would just talk to us about some of your thoughts that you've had through the week as this has unfolded.
I think good riddance. It's about time. Those are thoughts that went through my head. Also, I think we have seen examples of what I would call false progress. And I think what happened at Bon Appetit is kind of an example of that, because over the past few years, Bon Appetit did seemingly try to incorporate more Black and Brown people, more people of color. But what this entire scenario over the past, 48 hours has shown is that it was actually kind of an example of tokenism and an example of huge inequity within an organization. And that they were basically pretending to be more diverse in the areas that are really important in terms of inclusion were not paid attention to. You know, people weren't paid for their labor or weren't paid the same amount as their colleagues. You know, people were kind of performing their identities and not given roles of leadership. So I think it's an illustration of the fact that there are certain power structures in place at various media outlets that will kind of perform a certain kind of progress. But when you look at the actual hierarchy and the actual structure and the actual pay scales, there's not much progress at all. So I'm really grateful for all that has been revealed. But I feel like there's a lot of catch-up work that has to be done, and things have to be made right. And frankly, I'm grateful that there are other publications, independent publications out, such as a Whetstone magazine, that are examples of a more balanced and equitable and actually inclusive magazine.
And you're giving us another wonderful one. And I look forward to having you back when For the Culture is published.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Clancy. I appreciate you coming by.
My pleasure. Thank you so much. Take care.
You too. That was Clancy Miller, author of Cooking Solo, The Fun of Cooking for Yourself. She's also the founder and editor of the magazine For the Culture. I always say that food is a lens, and food publishing is just another tiny window to look at the world. The uproar at Bon Appetit this week reminded me of a conversation I had with Bryant Terry 6 years ago. It was 2014 when we covered the problematic project that is Thug Kitchen, a wildly popular vegan blog that spawned 3 cookbooks and a line of merch. I interviewed both the thugs, who turned out to be a white couple from Hollywood, and noted vegan activist Bryant Terry, who wrote a piece for CNN about the myriad problems stemming from the appropriative voice used by the authors in both their blog and cookbook. With food media Twitter blowing up this week to put high-profile publishers and editors' feet to the fire, we thought it was appropriate to revisit these conversations. Hi, Bryant. I know this week has been incredibly difficult. So thank you for finding the emotional space to come talk to us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on, Evan. The past couple of months have been incredibly and emotionally draining. But I'm excited to get at it and talk about these issues.
So why did you decide to post this story from 6 years ago to Instagram this week?
Okay, I want you to bear with me for a second, Evan, because I feel like I need to fully lay out the arc of, you know, all these events in order for people to really understand what's going on. So, you know, as I lay out in the CNN article, I, like many people, was intrigued by the TK blog at first. And, you know, I certainly thought it was a little contrived and over the top, but I genuinely thought it was a Black person behind the site. And, you know, I come from organizing. I'm an activist. And one of the cornerstones of organizing is meet people where they are. So I really thought that this was like some Black kid, Black teenager, young Black person who was attempting to do this kind of culturally appropriate outreach to young people who, you know, when we talk about what's imagined when one hears that word thug, for most people, I think, you know, young Black men living in urban centers in neighborhoods that are often kind of considered the ghetto or what have you. And so, you know, it was revealed that the authors of the blog and the book, Michelle and Matt, were white. A lot of people felt duped. I felt duped. A lot of people who had been kind of enthusiastically following their blog felt duped because there was this assumption that they were a Black couple. And the thing is, you know, I didn't feel the need to. I'm one of those people who tries to avoid conflict. I'm always trying to like bridge, you know, the chasms and bring people together. So I talked about it privately with colleagues, and, you know, most of my Black colleagues with whom we discussed the blog and the book felt like they agreed. They felt like it trafficked in racist stereotypes that have many historical precedents. And to be honest with you, I didn't really feel any need to go public because I was sure. I was like, the people are going to take care of this. There are going to be so many people who've bombarding their Twitter page and their Facebook page back then, letting them know. And they were. And I actually, you know, would visit and see people who were very vocal about how problematic the project was. But then I noticed that they were somebody on the TK team was systematically deleting any disapproving comments. So I wrote the piece because I felt like there needed to be a public record of people's dissent and the way in which many people disapproved of it. And wouldn't you know, 6 years later, here we are. And I think, I hope that this historical moment that we're in, you know, people's lens can allow them to understand what I and many people were trying to voice back then. I want to add one thing, and I feel like this is vitally important for people to understand. When the blog first came out, you know, when I discovered it in its earliest stages, there was this very specific pose that the authors were taking. And you know, the memes that went along telling people to hydrate, Emmer Effer, or, you know, whatever they were saying. It, you know, these were very specific. As I noted in the article, you know, the type of things that they were saying came from popular rap lyrics, Black comedians, just like general kind of like Black vernacular and colloquialisms. And so as, you know, the blog gained in popularity, and then they were getting attention from publishers, and then, you know, especially when, you know, the book was published and they were getting called out, it was hilarious to me that, you know, this term didn't exist back then, or at least it wasn't in, you know, the lexicon in the way it is now, but they were gaslighting people. And then I feel like people were gaslighting me, their defenders, and saying, you know, oh, no, 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 no. They're just cursing. You're actually racist if you think cursing is somehow connected to African-Americans. You're the racist. And I just want, you know, people to understand that, you know, when when you historicize that whole project and go to the beginning, it wasn't just about them cursing. You know, now that's the kind of like mantra. Well, we're just foul mouth. We just use the F word a lot. But there's a very specific history in this country, you know, particularly in the early 20th century of, you know, white people making fun of Blacks, pretending to be Black, you know. And so I'm not going to get too deep in that history, but I just think it's important to, you know, address that spin because that's not what it was about. That's maybe what they wanted it to be about when they were getting called out, but that wasn't what it was about in the beginning, just them being foul-mouthed and cursing.
When I re-listened to our conversation that we had after your piece, I think one of the things for me that really stood out was I asked them if any editor at a publishing house where they were had expressed concern at the language that they were using. And she said, no, not one person. Mm-hmm. And that to me then, and obviously now, just speaks volumes that there was not one person in that entire process of oversight that could see from a different point of view.
And maybe the question, you know, I think if I would have asked a question, I would have asked, did any of the people who were hoping to acquire this book project, did they see it as racist? Because I don't have any problem with the language. I mean, one of my closest friends, Adam Mansbach, wrote this book, Go to F to Sleep. It's replete with profanities. It's like a pretend kids book. I have a problem with the kind of like blackface minstrelsy that I kind of see this as, you know, digital blackface, cyber blackface. And I'm more concerned that there weren't editors and publishers that caught that and really took a step back and said, you know, this is a problem. Are you like, you know, great, you're enthusiastic, we like what you're doing, but you might want to reconsider that. And I don't think that happened either.
Yeah, obviously.
You know, the issue with the kitchen is connected to the uprisings that are happening around the world and the anti-racist movement that is growing. You know, I think that we can't talk about that the kitchen dust up without talking about the dust up at Bon Appetit because of its discriminatory workplace culture. I think it's connected to these issues as well. And I think the thread that runs through all of these things is the issue of white people so often refusing to listen when Black people and other people of color say that they're offended or that they're in pain or that they feel marginalized or unseen. And so many people, I mean, look, for God's sake, I wrote an op-ed on CNN as articulately and, you know, as much as I can do in an op-ed laying out why this was a problem and exactly how it was problematic. And, you know, they didn't budge. So I don't know if they care, if they're listening. I have a couple of suggestions for things that they might want to do if they want to, you know, quote unquote, fix this. First of all, I think they should apologize to Black people. Secondly, I think they need to admit that they have seen and heard criticisms of their work for 6 years and that they ignored them. And lastly, they just need to change that name.
I feel like this whole conversation, all of the protests, all of the talk that's been going on in food media this week, at the root of it is a discussion about power. And with power, you're also talking about money, right? And of course, all of that is embedded in the food world and the publishing world.
I mean, it's all about the money. And I highly doubt that in this current moment that a book like The Kitchen could be published. But as you know, the upper management, the editors, the publishers, you know, people working on the staff at these publishing houses, I mean, they're largely white. And there are a lot of historical reasons why that's the case and contemporary as well. But I think the reality is that those spaces need to be diversified as well. Because I'm pretty sure if there were more Black people in the rooms when books like this were being acquired, I think they, you know, let the team know why this is probably not a good idea. So I'm hoping that as we're seeing all these changes with the kind of shaking up of food media and media in general, that people move beyond the platitudes and posting a black box on their social media and really work for substantive change where the power lies, so that we can actually move forward. Because, you know, if a year from now we're still spinning our wheels and, you know, we're not really quickly making the type of moves that are going to change people's lives, then we're just going to wind up back at the same place again.
I love talking to you. Thank you so much, Bryant.
Thank you, Evan. Appreciate you always having me on.
Bryant Terry is an author, food justice advocate, and the chef in residence at the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco. His latest book is Vegetable Kingdom. Coming up, as Mayor Garcetti unveiled his Alfresco Dining Initiative, making it easier for restaurants to use sidewalks for dining, some wondered why street vendors who have long occupied sidewalks weren't included. That story when Good Food continues. And we're back. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. This week, as I drove around Los Angeles, I saw a sight I hadn't seen in months. Tables and chairs set up on sidewalks with customers eating, often with a mask hanging from one ear. I've become so used to the absence of restaurant life that to see it was jarring. 8 days ago, as the protests and outrage over the death of George Floyd crescendoed, Los Angeles approved the reopening of restaurants, and Mayor Garcetti announced his Alfresco Dining Initiative, allowing restaurants to use sidewalks and parking lots as outdoor dining areas. Many who have followed the fight to legalize street vending in Los Angeles wondered what this would mean for street vendors. Rudy Espinoza is the executive director of Inclusive Action for the city, a nonprofit that led the initiative to legalize street vending. Hi, Rudy.
Hi, Evan.
I feel like we've been having this conversation for a decade. Is that possible?
It is possible. It's longer than that. But so you're actually right on the money.
It's just insane how long this has taken. And I know that the work that you and the vendors, the activists, have put in took so much work. I can't imagine how hard it must have been to watch as the pandemic rolled back so much of that progress.
Yeah, it was terrible. This year, January 1st of 2020, the permit system that vendors long fought for was launched. And it was launched a little bit clumsily, and we were working with the city of Los Angeles to try to fix that. And then in the middle of March, we were hit with the COVID-19 pandemic, which obviously basically decimated the sales for a lot of vendors because everybody was staying at home. And then shortly after that, Evan, the city council was saying, hey, go support restaurants and go support food businesses and take your food to go. They actually went ahead and basically said no unlicensed vending can take place in the city. Whereas right before the pandemic, they were sort of giving folks an opportunity to get their self formalized. So they've been hit really hard.
When I think about gathering safely to eat outside the home, buying from a street vendor seems like one of the better options to safely distance, especially given that restaurants are now allowed to use parking lots and sidewalks. And some agencies have been so unusually accommodating, like the Alcohol Beverage Control, for example, that it seems the time would be now to make this change rather than make it harder.
Yes, I think that now is the time for that. You know, the issue that we've been fighting for a long time is sidewalk vendors are entrepreneurs, just like any type of entrepreneurs. They're different. They may have a different clientele or have a different product or service, but they're business owners. They rely on revenue and they rely on sales, and then they have their own expenses. And I think when we think about the recovery, and we think about recovering from COVID-19, we also have to think about how do we make sure that the most vulnerable entrepreneurs among us are part of that.
I understand that there was a meeting about the rollout of this new Alfresco initiative. How did it pertain to street vending, or does it at all?
That's a great question, Evan. both the city of Los Angeles and the county of Los Angeles are right now exploring how sidewalks in public spaces can support the food industry. A couple of weeks ago, the mayor unveiled the Alfresco program, which allows restaurants to apply for permits to use the sidewalk. And Tuesday, the county supervisors voted to explore a similar motion for sidewalk dining in the county of Los Angeles. So this is good stuff. But on both cases, unfortunately, sidewalk vendors were not included in those motions.
Yeah. You know, we always talk about how food businesses are kind of the first rung. Oftentimes, it's a low barrier to entry.
Yes.
And street vending in particular is that. So it seems like we would want to give as much support as possible to these businesses just now.
Yeah, Evan, and I hope that we do. I mean, I think, you know, right now we're in a really fascinating, interesting time in our country and especially in our city. I mean, there was thousands of people all over our city streets this weekend advocating for change, honoring George Floyd and other Black Americans who were murdered by police. But a narrative is coming out of this of like, what are we investing in? You know, where are our budgets going? And I think it's an opportunity for us to discuss and talk and have some action behind the idea of how do we make sure that we're investing in businesses in the right way? Because unfortunately, even though there's been attempts during this pandemic to support businesses through the federal programs like the PPP program, a lot of Black and Latino businesses have not received those resources, especially street vendors, some of whom are undocumented and are not even eligible for federal assistance. So this is an opportunity for us to reimagine what type of economy we want. And, you know, the folks on the LA Street Vendor campaign are really working to ensure that the economy includes vendors too.
Let's hope for the best.
Yeah.
And keep the pressure on.
Yeah. Thank you, Evan.
Thank you, Rudy. Rudy Espinosa is the Executive Director of Inclusive Action for the city. After we recorded that interview with Rudy, City Council member Monica Rodriguez called for an emergency $5 million fund that would directly benefit street food vendors. We'll be following the story in the coming days and weeks and keep you updated. That is it for our show this week, and wow, what a week it was. Before I go, I want to share with you some wise words that came from a colleague this week. During an email exchange, I unthinkingly referred to this incredible period in history as a moment. He rightfully reprimanded me and said, "It's not a moment, it's a movement." Let's all remember that and continue to learn, unlearn, and stay vigilant. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks, so many thanks this week in particular, to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Desmond Taylor, Kat Yore, and Paul Smith. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Kenny Ng. I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.